Today's case file will be on case 82 in the Blue Rock Collection. Tai Ryu's Indestructible Dharma Body. Tai Ryu's Indestructible Dharma Body. Engo's introduction. The fishing line at the end of the rod, the one with eyes, will know. The spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary, the enlightened one will discern. What then is the fishing line at the end of the rod and the spiritual activity which transcends the ordinary? See the following. A monk said to Tai Ryu, man's body will ultimately decompose. What is the indestructible Dharma body? Tai Ryu said, flowers cover the hillside like brocade. The veil lies deep in shade. Secho's verse. The question came from ignorance. The answer was not understood. The moon is clear. The wind is cool. The wintry pine stands on the peak. I laugh heartily to hear the saying, when you encounter a man of the way, meet him with neither words nor non-words. He held the crystal whip and smashed the jewels. Otherwise, faults develop. For there are laws in the land with 3,000 regulations. Monk said to Tai Ryu, man's body will ultimately decompose. What is the indestructible Dharma body? So today is the last day of our wonderful August Sesshin. And I want to thank everybody for doing such a marvelous job. You all have been really practicing, and it's been thrilling. When you come into Dokusan, it's just wonderful to see what everybody is doing. And I thank you for that. Somebody came in, you know, we all have these moments, you know, where, or at least let me just say, I have had my moments in my practice where I've been sitting on the cushion, struggling, getting nowhere, and thinking, you know, I mean, it's bound to happen. Sometimes you just think, you know, this could just be a bunch of bullshit. You know? You know, I remember I was working with the koan on what does Buddha ride? Yeah. And I had spent many years working on the breath perception koan and the mu koan, many more years on the mu koan. And Genki always used to say, Genki Roshi always used to say, you know, once you've passed the Mu Koan, that's the great barrier. And in the Mu Monkan, Master Wu Men says, once you've passed the Mu Koan, you know, your eyebrows will be intertwined with the eyebrows of the Buddhas and the great Zen teachers. So I thought, my eyebrows are now intertwined. And so surely these koans will not be so tough, you know. Genki Roshi gave me this koan on what does Buddha ride. So it's like, all right, you know, this is going to be, you know, a cakewalk. Right? And, you know, it just took forever and ever. And I remember I was at a summer sesshin at our temple. By then we had this place up in the mountains, and a retreat place, Tokuganji, our temple. And I remember going through the whole sesshin, again, it was that familiar experience of everybody going into the Dokusan room and answering their koans. And, you know, I had many, you know, I would go deeply into mu, and I just couldn't answer this koan. And I remember just toward the last day, just sitting there thinking, this is just a bunch of crap, you know. That was my karma, Yeah, that's who I was. But I really had, you know, doubts or intellectual doubts, and I wish I could have gone in and talked to my teacher about, what is this all about, you know, and it's complicated because the teacher doesn't want to engage in philosophy, but sometimes a little explanation would be helpful. And when a person comes in to ask me a question about what we're doing, you know, please don't ever think that I'll take it personally. I'll be offended or hurt, or if you say, look, I'm sitting here calling moo, you know, what is this all about? You know, this seems very contrived and very artificial. You know, you're not going to hurt my feelings if you say, the person who came in to see me in Dokusan didn't say, I think this is bullshit, fortunately. And even if the person said that, it wouldn't hurt my feelings, you know, because I've been there, believe me. So what the person said was just like an honest question. I don't think there is a moo, and I don't know what we're doing, you know. And it was like, I'm so glad you asked that question. So, you know, I thought it was such a good question, I wanted to, and it's connected to the koan, I wanted to, you know, just explain a little bit, you know, what we're up to with this crazy practice, because indeed it does seem very weird. I mean, if you weren't in this Zen world and you came in here and you saw these people going, you know, you'd think that was strange, you know. And also, it's a little strange, right, that you're supposed to go into the teacher and go, ooh, and something serious is supposed to happen, right, you know? Let me do my best to just explain, what this is all about. And I thought it was such a good question, you know? My feeling is that most people are held in a kind of semi-stupor by their cultural conditioning and their personal life choices. You know, so really and truly, I think a lot of people feel they're not really alive, not fully alive. You know, and I think as we get older, our world contracts more and more. We get adept at a small range of things, but you know, we stop experimenting, a lot of people do anyway, and a lot of life is sort of like a painful process of having doors closed in your face. It begins when you're very little and parents say to you, say to your brother, Billy, wouldn't you like a football outfit? And then they say to you, wouldn't you like to be the princess? You say, no, I want the football outfit, right? Or whatever. The point is that you're told, no, you're not. You don't want the football outfit. You want the princess outfit. So this is like a door closing, yeah? All through our lives, these doors are closing on us, and we're told you have to be a certain kind of person. They would say, you know, that just isn't done. You know, that just isn't done. You get the signal that just isn't done, and then, you know, if you get it enough, you're always worried. You know, everybody has these anxieties that they're going to do something that's like this terrible faux pas, and everybody's going to be offended. Right? You know, this is like a constant fear that we all have, that we're going to, well, did I say something? And you look around at all the horrified or angry faces, we grow up learning to be cautious and to anticipate gaffes and failures And we get very good at sort of keeping a low profile and not breaking any of the china in the house, and so on and so on, you know. And our world gets very small as we get older. And I think most people notice, it's not always true, but I think a lot of people notice that as they get older, there's a kind of loss of spontaneity. You know, there's a loss of spontaneity. I mean, I can remember as a kid, you know, when rainstorms would come, just getting tremendously excited. This was before the bike on which I knocked myself out. I had this little bike. And when the rain would come, I'd jump on the bike and I would be so excited. I would just ride around the apartment complex where, you know, it was just like, oh my God, the rain is coming. You know, you could imagine what people would think of an adult who behaved that way, right? But you know, it's not less wonderful than it used to be. I swear, you know this, if you're at Sesshin, you know, we've had August Sesshins where the rain has been incredible. I mean, in this place, we've had Sesshins where you could hear the rain beating on the roof and the thunder is crashing all around us. And it's just astounding, right? It's just beautiful and amazing. So, you know, the world is not less wonderful than we were little kids. It's just we've closed a lot of doors on ourselves. You know, and this is part of the educational process, you know. In a graduate course on poetry, you're not supposed to go, you know, wow, this is a fantastic poem, you know. That's just like, that's just not done. You know, one of the first things they tell you in a literature study class is that there's appreciation and there's criticism. And it's like, keep your appreciation to yourself, you know. And now, let's destroy this work of poetry. You happen to like it, you can park that at the door. So, you know, you realize you keep your enthusiasms to yourself, you know, and, you know, as you get older, that the child who used to, you know, love to ride the bike around when the rain is coming, you know, does something sort of inconspicuous, you know, putters about in the garden, you know, this is sort of the little world we live in, you know, and this is a this goes on so many levels, and it's so pervasive, you know, that our behavior gets circumscribed in countless ways, you know. But also, our experience, our thinking gets circumscribed. There are just things we just don't pursue, you know. My mother was a wonderful painter, you know. She's now painting in her old age. But when I was a kid, we lived in this apartment complex in Baltimore. And my mother was like this very creative person who had very few outlets for her creativity. And she did a mural on the wall of our room from scratch. And she had like things from nursery rhymes, like the cat and the fiddle and the cow jumping over the moon. And I'm not kidding, I can still remember those. They were incredibly good. I mean, my mother could have been a commercial artist, you know. She was so good, or maybe a professional artist, but certainly it was in the genre of like commercial art, and it was so good. So, you know, she sort of put away her paints for 30 some years, you know, and it was, you know, it's just, this is not what a, you know, basically this is not what a housewife does in the 60s, you know. So I think she got the message that this was not part of the routine, and this was like a door that closed on herself. So you know, our experiential world gets smaller and smaller, and also even the range of our senses becomes more and more circumscribed. You know, so it's like the whole world on every level. You know, experience, thinking, activity. And even sensation becomes, you know, gradually smaller, smaller, smaller. And, you know, people are easy to manage if they're all the same. and so on. So, you know, it becomes very difficult to have a spontaneous relationship with the world, a truly, I would say, natural relationship with things. And it becomes very difficult to act naturally, because we're always trying to be, we have all of these voices in our head saying, no, you don't want the football uniform, you want the princess outfit, right? You know, so, you know, if people who love you and care about you tell you you want the princess outfit, it puts you in a terrible situation, right? Because they really do love you, and they really do care for you, and you really do love them. So, you know, at some point you begin to say, okay, I do want the princess outfit. And this is so widespread. You know, you see this in education also, where, you know, basically somebody will bring in a poem into a class, and it might be somebody like, you know, Edna St. Vincent Millay. I don't know if you've ever read anything by her. But, you know, a lot of people turn up their nose on at this point. And maybe she's not a great poet, you know. But I remember that a teacher brought in a poem by her and didn't tell us who it was, who the author was. And people began to appreciate it and enjoy it until the teacher said it was Edna St. Vincent. It was like, oh, they dropped a hot potato. It was like, oh my God, what have you, you know. And they almost got mad at the teacher. It's like, you tricked us into liking something we know we shouldn't like. You know? So that was a teacher I had in graduate school. So you know, this process is so pervasive, and it becomes very hard. You know, you can say to some people, what would you like? You know, what would you like to do? And they're literally stupefied. You know, people have gone to school for 14, 16 years, 12 years of high school, and then 4 years of college, and at the end you say, well, what do you want to do? And they're stupefied by the question. It's like, want to do? You know, all my life people have been telling me what I have to do or should do. I have no idea what I want to do. And that's astounding, isn't it? That's astounding to me. You know, you're literally flummoxed by the question, what do you want to do? And so, you know, we kind of confine we confine the things we want to do to a range of things like, well, my favorite color is blue, you know, or, you know, I like Chinese food, you know. I mean, those are small expressions of maybe spontaneity, but it's so constrained and we're so arrested, and we feel it all the time, I think, on many levels, and I think it creates all kinds of problems for people. So, you know, one way to understand what we're trying to do with Zen practice is like deconditioning the mind. And actually being able to have a way to answer that question, what do you want to do? See, without the perpetually divided consciousness. You know, divided consciousness, you know, you think, well, I might want to do this, but then I might want to do that. But I might want to do this, then I... This is a product of all the voices in your head, all the people in your life telling you what you should want to do. And of course, they never told you the same thing. So there's all these contradictions running around in your head. So when you say, well, do I want to do this or don't I? You know, you're pulled in many different directions, and it's like all these different selves. You have all these different selves saying, do it, don't do it. Right. You know, and you say, how am I to choose? And what most people do is they look to authority. They look to the head of the class, you know, somebody they admire, and they try to model their choices after what the authority does. And this is exactly what happens in school. You know, you learn that you shouldn't like Edna St. Vincent Millay because your teacher doesn't. Your teacher goes, oh, well, we don't read that kind of poetry in here. We only read Wallace Stevens. So this is how education goes. You learn, and I see graduate students who are very nice people. And their teachers are nice people, but they get trapped, you know. And I'll see the students, and they'll start sounding like their professors. It's amazing. Like, we had a guy in our department named Richard Poirier. And Poirier was from Maine. And he had the most atrocious Maine accent you ever heard. And when he would say the word modern, he would say modern. This is modern poetry. I can't even do it, you know, modern. I had a student who was in his class, and he said it took him several months to realize he was saying modern. He said, I thought it was like maudlin something, you know, modern. This is modern. The modern, you know. And so I would begin to hear graduate students say modern. And I said, it's not modern. In New Jersey, it's modern. Modern. It's not modern. But I'm not condemning them. I'm not condemning Mr. Poirier, you know, who's now retired. But it's just a natural thing when you grow up and you get split into all these different competing selves, that you look to somebody to stabilize it for you, you know? And you think, well, Poirier must have his act together. He must know what he really wants. I'll imitate Poirier. But you know, you don't know that. He could be just as screwed up. You know, he could be just as divided. So this is how the whole system works, right? Everybody's looking to somebody else as having resolved this issue. And it's very doubtful. Many people are, you know, they're just, as I said the other day, you know, I have friends of mine who are like the authorities in their field, and they're much better scholars than I'll ever be. I mean, if I had 1,000 lives, I would never be able to do what they've done. But you know, I've had, you know, occasion where they've said to me, "Oh, I feel like such a big phony." And it's like, "You? But you are the embodiment of 18th century literary studies. How can you be a phony?" But it's because maybe they're not doing what they really wanted to do. You know, maybe they're just trying to please Dad, you know. And loving your father is a good thing, you know, and sometimes Dad's right about things. But you can't live Dad's life, you have to live your own life. You know, so this is really very central to Zen. You know, how do I live naturally and spontaneously? And break out of this vicious circle, you know. And it begins with breath perception, you know. First of all, we have to be able to detach ourselves from all of these messages, you know, which possess us and make us move like puppets on a string. You know, most people don't realize they're having thoughts and emotions. They just have thoughts and emotions. See, there's a big difference between somebody who knows he's having a thought or an emotion and somebody who is simply having them. See, one day, what happens to most people is they just get mad. See, they just get mad. Or they suddenly think, I could lose my job. And then they're filled with terror. Now, if you begin, so really, these are thoughts that, you know, these are just ideas and thoughts that are in general circulation. They're like money. None of the things we put into, unless we work very hard to make language fresh and alive, most of it is just like, money that's in common circulation, and it's not original at all. You know? So basically, these thoughts like, I could be on the street. You know, my father always used to say to me, do you want to be on the street? You know? He said, well, you're going to dig ditches, young man. You know, in other words, if I didn't try, he'd say, you want to dig ditches? That's fine. So, you know, when I'm doing something, I could be on the street. I could be digging ditches, you know. And my father got it from somebody else. It's like money. It just passes on, right? You know. So a lot of Zen practice is deconditioning the mind, and the beginning of that is not letting these things possess you. So, you know, if you begin to watch your breath, you begin to focus on the breath, you know, it's like you watch the breath, eventually you reach a state where you see your thoughts coming and going, and you're not possessed by them so much. You don't follow them in the direction they want to go. You see them and you let them come and you let them go. And you stay fixed on the breath. The breath is like this point from which you can watch the thoughts come and go. We open a space between yourself, your awareness, and your thoughts. And this may seem trivial. Maybe you've been doing this for years, but this is the beginning of liberation, and it's a great achievement. It's the beginning of liberation. It's the most wonderful thing in the world not to be possessed by thought. You know, what happens sometimes after you get accomplished at this is you can see your thoughts and you can see your emotions and not be possessed by them. So maybe something happens at work and instead of getting mad, you see your anger arising. And you say, oh my God, anger's arising. I didn't know that. And I didn't know that was in me. And so then you don't allow yourself to be possessed by the anger. You see it, but you don't act it out because now you've created this space. This is like so important. So this is the beginning of deconditioning the mind and setting free the indestructible Dharma body. Yeah. So now it might be a little more possible to be natural and not be divided because we're not going to let thoughts possess us and be the zombies of thoughts, you know. There's other ways to do this. You know, artists and writers do this by trying to refashion language, to use language in a way against its own staleness or against its own clichédness. Or artists try to create, you know, new images, new ways of seeing. So. Same, but in Zen, the method is minding mind, watching the thoughts come and go and creating this space. Okay. Now, it's still difficult for people, even then, to be truly spontaneous and natural. Now, it's very difficult. And, you know, as soon as we try to act, all of those voices kick in. You know, all of those voices kick in, and we think, oh my God, you know, I'm going to be on the street. I'm going to dig ditches. I'm going to be a flop. My father used to say, my father was a human being, and like anybody else. He wanted to help me. He grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey. He was born in East Orange. You know, his parents had trouble buying him shoes, you know, affording shoes. His father was a fixed cars, you know. And my father had this tremendous upward mobility drive. He wanted to be, my father wanted to own Florsheim shoes. You know, my father actually had Florsheim shoes that were 20 years old in his closet, and his idea of a good time on a Saturday was taking out the shoes and shining his shoes, and looking at all his Florsheims, you know. This is called World Gets a Little Smaller. My father just, one of the things he used to say to me was, Kurt, there's no room for number two. And he had a cigar, you know, he'd be in his undershirt, and he'd tell me, there's no room for number two. And by the way, I love my father. He's dead now, but I love him, and I loved him. He meant the best for me. You know, but that was very difficult to take when I was in the Zen community in Seattle, and everybody else was in. We all started, about 40 people, we all started training with Genki, and then everybody was answering their koans except me, you know. And so I wasn't number two. If I had been number two, I'd have been really happy, you know. So I was number 40, you know, out of 40, you know. So, you know, it was humiliating and difficult to deal with. You know, and all the time, you know, I wouldn't listen to the voice, but it was there, and it made me it made it difficult for me to practice Zen because I wanted to be I wanted to be a Zen success, right? Not a Zen failure. Right? And so every time I would go to Dokusan, it was humiliating and difficult for me because it was like failing a test. You know, and I would come out of the Dokusan room feeling, you know. I loved meditation. It felt better. it felt better. I felt more alive. But I interpreted, you know, Dokusan and koan training as like a test I kept failing. So it created a kind of contradiction. And I tried so many things in Dokusan. I tried to be creative, spontaneous, energetic, you know, and this is very human. This is what we all do, you know. I mean, the idea is to act, and you know, there's nothing special about mu. You know, we could pick a different activity. You know, all of us have had moments where we've suddenly been transported or carried out of ourselves and we feel connected to a bigger life. You know, it could, before I started Zen, for me it was hiking. You know, I would hike 10 or 15 miles a day. I would just get this feeling of, like, I'm indestructible, immortal, you know. I would go zipping down those trails and this beautiful, feel connected to everything. It was just fantastic. You know, so what we could do is have like a hiking session, right? We could all go hiking, you know. We'd all go down the thing and I say, are you feeling it yet? You know, are you getting that sense of transport? It would be difficult, right? Also, if ceramics is your game, some people work on a wheel, right? You know, you can throw the wheel, you can throw a pot on a wheel, you know. You know, first it's very difficult and it feels so artificial. You know, it's like you can't make the clay. I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I imagine you can't make the clay, the thing stand up, you know, it wants to whirl out, you know, and so you're trying to shape it and you're trying to center it and it's off center and it's just so unnatural. But, you know, if you do it long enough, it becomes natural. You know, you begin to harmonize with the clay. You don't think self-consciously about the activity. And, you know, one day you just sit down and this, you know, this beautiful object emerges and it's not even like you made it. It just came, right? It just came. And so we could have like a pottery session. We all throw pots, you know. But, you know, what we've got here is something very, very simple. We're working with, an activity is best, you know. In other words, you know, if you want spontaneity for various reasons, an activity is best. So we've picked an activity that's very, very simple. Just calling, just vocalizing. And it's like the breath is also like this. You know, you could develop one-pointed mind by looking at a candle, for example. But what if you don't have a candle? You know, breath is even more accessible. And the good thing about the breath is that if you don't breathe, you die. So it's absolutely crucial. And the other thing is, actually, even though people don't realize it, the breath is an amazing phenomenon. It's a whole body experience, right? And it connects your conscious mind to your unconscious mind. See? So breath is very complicated and very beautiful and wonderful because, of course, if you go to sleep, you don't stop breathing. This is interesting. You know, actually, if you knock a dolphin out, it can drown because it'll stop breathing. Their brains are wired differently. So it's very fortunate for us that, you know, of course, we don't live in water, you know, but the thing is, the breath comes whether we will it to come or not. See, breath comes whether we choose. So it comes from the deeper self, beyond our willing and doing. See, so much superior to a candle in that regard. Breath comes from the deeps, from the true nature. Right? You can't say yes or no. So it's like a messenger from the deeper self. But really and truly, breath is like an angel. It's like a messenger. Very important. This holy breath. Sacred breath. So, you know, much better than a candle. And a calling mu also, see, whole being experience, whole body experience. And what we're trying to do is to be possessed by the universe, this spontaneous action, unself-conscious. You know, it happens to all of us by accident. You know, you're suddenly doing something and you just, boom, you're in the flow. right? You're in the Tao. And then boom, you're out. And you think, where did it go? Why couldn't I stay? Well, from the Zen standpoint, you couldn't stay because of, you know, you closed all these doors. All those voices make you too self-conscious, too fearful of failure, too greedy for results, you know, because that's also kind of fear, right? So the whole point is, let's just act, and eventually it may be spontaneous. Begin to open that door into the deeper self, the indestructible Dharma body. So this is the logic of calling mu. It could be, each person could have a brush and some ink and some rice paper, and each person could come into Dokusan and do a stroke, right? You could be practicing out here and you'd say, oh, this is so artificial. You know, I just can't get into this today. You know, but after 1,000 strokes, you know, maybe you'd come into Dokusan, boom. You know, it would be like the clap of thunder, right? Just totally natural and non-self-conscious. So it doesn't have to be mu. There's nothing mysterious about mu. It has the advantage of being whole body experience and also connected to the deeper self, the unconscious mind. You know, one of the first things you did when you came into this world was cry out, yes, with your whole being. Yes, maybe you were calling mu. So, you know, how to do this though? How to do this? And the thing is, you know, there's a school of thought, so-called, that would be like this. I'm sitting on the cushion and I'm trying to feel spontaneous, and then I'm going to call mu. So, you know, you could just be waiting for spontaneity to happen, and sometimes indeed you're just sitting there. If you're not trying, nothing's going to happen. But if you're trying and it's just not, you know, it feels very labored and forced, and then all of a sudden, boom, you're in the zone. You really feel like this is it. You know, that can happen. The truth is, it's not probably a good strategy to wait for inspiration to come. If you act, in other words, if you're waiting to act until the inspiration comes, you will probably wait for almost ever. So let me be clear. If you're waiting for inspiration to come before you act, you will grow old and gray. Okay? But the thing is, act and maybe the inspiration will come. You know, so there's two kinds, this is a generalization and probably totally unfounded, but my feeling is that there's two kinds of like artists, you know. I have friends who are poets, and they write very little poetry because they wait. They're not really engaged poets because they wait just for the inspiration to come. So they write poetry when they're bidden to by inspiration. You know? And so they haven't written much, you know. On the other hand, I have friends who are poets and prose writers who sit down very sort of regularly and work at it, you know. And as they're working at it, the inspiration comes, you know. And this is how, I'm not an artist, but even I experience this, you know. Like, if I waited to have a good idea, I would publish nothing, you know. What happens is I just start writing. And as I'm writing, this stuff comes out. And it's like, well, that's a good idea. And it's really not my idea, because I didn't think it. It's just I started working on this, and all this good stuff comes out. A lot of it goes in the trash, you know, but there might be, out of, you know, a certain number of pages, you think, well, now this is worth doing something. You know, where did that come from? See, so it's like, don't wait for the inspiration to hit. Just act, and little by little, you know, if you act enough, if you call mu enough, the inspiration is just going to hit. You know, so act, don't wait for inspiration, act, and inspiration may come, will come. You know, so it may seem really foolish to go out in the woods, for example, and scream moo. It's like, this is really stupid. But give it a try. Just give it a, you know, use the tick repellent or whatever, so you don't get Lyme disease, which is a big problem. But, you know, go out in the woods. I mean, what do you care what people think? You know, it's New Jersey. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, and what are they going to complain about? They're riding their motorcycles around in the woods, you know, that you're, you know, nobody's going to care. There's clearly no laws around here. So just go out in the woods and you know, and of course, self-consciousness is, you know, you know, very important. You know, I feel like a fool, this is stupid, and you call, you know, and I knew it. I knew I was going to be disappointed. I knew it would be nothing, you know. These are all voices of the spirit, very familiar, right? You know. But little by little, you know, if you're on the cushion and you're calling moo, you call moo in the Dokusan room, you call moo out in the forest, you know, lightning may strike. And when it strikes, it's like, holy smokes, where did that come from? But everybody who's, you know, scientists know this, you know, an idea just hits you. You know, you're looking, you're butting your head up against, you know, I mean, I think being a scientist takes such courage and determination, because I have a friend who's a scientist who actually just laughed once. He said, you know, most scientists, he said, live with almost perpetual failure. You know, most of our research doesn't work out. And he was laughing about it, which was great, you know. And he understood, you know, you try, and then boom, something just opens up, and it's like a whole new way of seeing something. You know, if you don't try, that's a problem. But, you know, if you're waiting for a good idea before you try, it's like nothing's gonna happen. And you know, the other aspect of this is how do you try in the right way, you know? Because there's an art to trying. And this is all complicated, but it's really wonderful, you know. You know, you can't make, you have to try, but you can't make lightning strike. You know, I went into Genki Roshi once. I was in such a, you know, I was so down about it. And I remember going into Genki Roshi and just, you know, saying, I don't know, I'm trying, but... And he said, look, you can't break the door down. You just have to knock at the door. You know, so, you know, you call, and the door's going to open. Lightning's going to strike. It's important to try, but then, in a way, not to care. Then try, but don't care. You draw the bow, and you let the arrow go. If you don't draw the bow, right, nothing is going to happen. And drawing the bow means tension, means trying, right, try. But where the arrow goes is beyond your control. Right, so many things are beyond our control, you know. And we have to trust that the arrow is going to go where it has to go. And everywhere the arrow goes is wonderful, see. Everywhere the arrow goes is wonderful. And out of so many tries, the arrow's going to hit the bullseye. And that's especially wonderful, right? You know. So, eventually you have a different attitude toward the whole thing. It's like every shot is a bullseye. Every shot is a bullseye. But for right now, for this stage in one's practice, there is a bullseye, so to speak. It's important not to get too impatient if you don't hit it. Now, the Chinese have this concept of wu wei. You know, this wu wei doesn't mean don't try. It doesn't mean, you know, don't even try. The Chinese have a brilliant creative tradition, thousands of years old, and great wisdom about this. And they understood try but don't try. You know, you have to do 1,000 strokes and then you pick up the brush and it's just this beautiful natural stroke. It's like the universe makes your hand go. But you have to do 1,000 strokes first, you know. And any one of them could be that marvelous, magical stroke. You just never know. So if you want to live the deep life, the real life of Zen, you just have to be trusting and patient, and you have to do 1,000 strokes. You have to call Mu 1,000 times. And one day lightning strikes. And then eventually you see it's always been striking. You know. So everybody's doing a wonderful job. You know, and I'm so glad that person asked me that question. Please don't ever hesitate. If you think something's bogus, let me know. You know? I mean, it could be a pickle. Yes, could be the pickle. Could be moo. You know? But I'm happy to hear. You know? Because there's no sense rattling around. You know, you're not supposed to take it on faith. You're supposed to, it's supposed to make some degree of sense, you know. And I think it does, you know. And if you stick with it, personally, I would recommend it highly. You know, it's really so, you know, feel free to ask. And actually, that person really helped me to think about how to talk about this koan. A monk said to Tai Ryu, man's body will ultimately decompose. What is the indestructible Dharma body? See, I mean, we're so, you know, we're so worried about life and death, failure and success, these kinds of considerations are so powerful. And yet, you know, really, very fanciful, even life and death, very abstract, really abstract. Maybe there's no such thing as life. Maybe there's no such thing as death. Maybe they're just ideas in general circulation. Life could be very, very different than that, you know, as I would say it is. So, how do I get out of all of these cliches, basically? All of these familiar ways of thinking and to encounter the indestructible Dharma body? And Tai Ryu says, flowers cover the hillside like brocade. The vale lies deep in shade. Hillside and vale are both. Hillside and vale, both. So you can't be in the wrong place. You can't be in the wrong place. So everywhere you shoot the arrow is okay. And see, that's the spirit. That's Wu Wei. I'm going to try, and then whatever happens is Buddha. Whatever happens is Buddha. And the most wonderful things will follow from that. The question came from ignorance, from all those cliches. See, all of that junk circulating around. All of them. You don't want the football uniform. You want the princess uniform. The answer was not understood. The moon is clear, the wind is cool, the wintry pine stands on the peak. Humans toil away in artifice, and there is this other way of life which is perfectly spontaneous. I laugh heartily to hear the saying, when you encounter a man of the way, meet him with neither words nor non-words. He held the crystal whip and smashed the jewels. Don't hold on to success or failure. This is like poison. Otherwise, faults develop. And as soon as you create good and evil, you create bad people, essentially. This goes back to the Tao Te Ching. Just be natural. For there are laws in the land with 3,000 regulations. The laws. This is what should be so. It should be so. But, the Tao, the way, is in your own heart. See, if you have to impose goodness on people, if you have to impose, these, then it's fruitless. Fruitless. It'll never work. You know, in you is infinite compassion. infinite Buddha, infinite love, infinite patience. You know, and we say, oh, it couldn't possibly be so. I just can't trust that. But this is what Zen practice is all about. Just remove the barriers and this amazing, amazing thing is in there. Indestructible time of body. So everybody's been hitting the target all the time. It's been wonderful. And so we have just a few precious hours left. We have this sit at 2:30, and then we have a shower period, the sutras, and one last period of meditation with the last dokusan. So it's not too late to, you know, slather up the bug killer or bug deter. We don't want to kill any bugs, we just want to deter them. And go out in the woods and try it. Anything can happen, yeah? So please, you know, value these precious hours that we have left together, and let's see what happens.